terror cells in Afghanistan after the war against the Taliban. A team of U.S. special forces were going door to door seeking insurgent forces. Trained to be sensitive to the culture, U.S. special forces worked behind the scenes, making alliances with local people. The team knocked on one door in a half-ruined mud compound. An old farmer let them in after allowing his female relatives to move to the back, out of the gaze of these strange men. When the team asked the man if he had any weapons, he proudly produced a century-old hunting knife and a rifle. They took time to admire it and then searched the house, carefully letting the women stay out of sight. The farmer then served them tea, and afterwards the Americans thanked him and left. As they moved down the street, they looked back to see six U.S. Army paratroopers, part of the same operation, preparing to break down that door of the same house. They yelled, but it was too late. The door crashed in, and the terrified farmer panicked and ran. He was attacked by a helmeted troop who rushed through the house, frisking the women for weapons. By the time the special forces captain could run back, the place was in chaos. The women were screaming. The family was in a state of shock. The captain said the guy was in tears because he had been completely dishonored. If you think about this story, it really vividly illustrates the importance of knowing the culture. If you think about it, both these people were on the same mission. One went in understanding the culture and got what they needed. The other one just barged in and didn't get it. As we begin our story of Jesus, culture more than any other factor is key to correct understanding of who our Jesus is. And so today what Marilyn and I would like to do is take you back into the first century Judea under Roman rule. And as she said, we're going to be covering social, religious, and the political day. So let's start with social life. The most important stabilizing factor in all of the Roman Empire was the family. So it didn't matter whether you were Roman or whether you were Jewish, it was patriarchal. And that meant that the oldest male had complete authority over the family. They lived in extended family units. Their houses were called insulas. We've seen them before, but if you think about a compound more than a house, you would have a wall around it, and then you would have one door, which is actually just a gate, which is locked from the inside at night. There are small dark rooms around the perimeter, and in the very center is a courtyard. And the courtyard is really where life takes place. That's where the patriarch sits to meet with the family. That's where the women cook, the children play, the animals gather. Everything kind of happens around in the courtyard. When I was in Galilee at Capernaum, we found an insula that had about 200 people. So you understand it's a large complex. It's not individual homes like what we're familiar with. Each family had a well-established social status. Everybody knew where they stood in society. They also knew who was below them and who was above them. Every family had an occupation. In Galilee, where Jesus was primarily, that would have been fishing or farming. People were very poor. It was more a subsistence existence. They were dependent upon the weather, but even more so, the ever-changing taxing. They had different goals than we do. Although people were ambitious, their goal was really to protect the status quo. What you wanted to make sure that was that your family did not lose its place in society. As a result, we have group mentality. When any decision was made, it was based upon what is good for the group, the family, never the individual. Just as the story of Afghanistan, honor and shame is extremely important. Parents would teach their children early in life the family values, their traditions, and that they would always bring honor to the family. And we're going to see in the Jewish families that that would be teaching the Torah, God's laws. And closely related to status was the Roman concept of patronage. I think we know about patrons and clients. I've seen it in a lot of things around here. But a patron was somebody of higher status that would provide protection and some sort of financial aid to a client of a lower status, and in return, that client was expected to be loyal, to obedient, and to bring the patron honor. Meals. I think you might want to be a Roman. They had four meals every day. Jews only had two, and they primarily ate grains, fruits, vegetables. They drank water and wine, Meats, yes, but they were basically during the festivals. Now, there's a very special meal called a banquet. I think if you studied the Bible at all, you're familiar with banquets, right? We see a lot of them, but what we don't understand is they are rituals of social status. If you had a banquet and invited somebody, you could use it either to bring honor or shame to them. So we're going to see how that plays out as Jesus' story unfolds. Styles, I love this. I'm always looking about styles. For most of the population, they all wore these kind of tunic-style garments. They were one piece. They were knee-length. They had a sash around the waist. That was men and women. And the women also wore a longer one over the top that would go to the floor. Hairstyles, I love. How do we see Jesus with this long, flowing hair, right? Yeah, well, that might be during the days of the patriarchs, but he would have stood out as very odd in the Roman Empire because every male had short hair. In fact, if you were Roman, it was more military style. I look at Billy Bob's hair. It would be more like that. If you were Jewish, it might be more like Detlef's, where you could actually comb it, but it would be short. Romans were clean-shaven. Jews had beards. Women of honor always wore long hair. If you were unmarried, you would not wear a veil. If you were married, in order to honor your husband, you would cover your hair only. Community life centered around the synagogue. A synagogue simply means assembly, and that is where you had school, where you had community meetings, where you would go for prayers, and of course, they would have Shabbat or Sabbath there. If you had 10 or more men in your village, then you would have a synagogue. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later. Hospitality was extremely important in the Middle East. In fact, to welcome a stranger into your home was to bring honor to the family. They were under your protection in your community there. Now, the guest then in turn would accept whatever hospitality that you offered them, but as they left, they would praise you to the community, which would again raise your honor in the community. And we're going to see how this plays out in some of Jesus' parables. When it comes to the religious structure, in the Old Testament, which we went through, we were very familiar with the temple. The temple is the center of everything. This is where God's name is. This is where they brought sacrifices. This is where they had the festivals and worshiped. This was the central place. It also was their identity as a nation. That was the Old Testament. It was destroyed by the Babylonians, but it was rebuilt. So now we are in what's called the Second Temple period. But there's something new now, and that's the synagogues. Old Testament didn't have synagogues. The New Testament does have synagogues. We also had priests and Levites in the Old Testament, right? In the New Testament, we don't. Now we have Sadducees and Pharisees. Judaism is still monotheistic. They worship only Yahweh, the one true God, the God of heaven and earth. He's the faithful God of the covenant. He's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he's the God that gave them Torah. That remained the same, but in Jesus' day, there are at least 22 different sects or parties. Today, we might say denominations. We're familiar with some of those, certainly scribes, Pharisees, and Sadducees. Some of them are more obscure, like the Essenes, the Zealots, Herodians, Zacharis, Hasidim. There's a whole bunch more. But for Jesus' story, we need to understand those that he interacted with, which are the Sadducees and the Pharisees. So the Sadducees, the name means righteous one. They came from the wealthy elite. They had complete authority over the temple and the priesthood and everything that went on there. Some of the Sadducees were priests, but not every priest was a Sadducee. And unfortunately, the name means righteous one. Josephus, our first century historian, says that they were argumentative, boorish, rude to each other and to everyone else. That's the Sadducees. They were both religious and political. They had embraced Hellenism, the Greek culture, believing that that was much better. They were pro-Roman because the Romans allowed them to have power. And they controlled the Sanhedrin, which is the Jewish high court. So even though they were smaller in number than the Pharisees, they were the majority. their beliefs. They only accepted the five books of Moses, which is Genesis through Deuteronomy, not the rest of what we would call the Old Testament or the oral traditions. They did not want or look for the Messiah in the line of David. Key point, if you've got a bookshelf on your mind, put this fact in. Sadducees don't want a Messiah. Why? Because they would lose their position. They are not looking, nor do they want one. I'm always looking for a tag. So they are sad, you see, because they don't believe in the resurrection, they don't believe in immortality of the soul, and they don't believe in angels. Therefore, they live for the here and now. Whatever they could get was what they wanted, and they wanted it all. Life revolved around Jerusalem, the temple, and they particularly loved the courts. Why? Because they were the only ones that had access to these inner courts. That's the Sadducees. The Pharisees are separatists, or those who separate. And what are they separated from? Well, from all the corrupt priests and Sadducees and anybody that had embraced Hellenism. They were also the other party in the Sanhedrin. So if you think of the Sanhedrin like the Senate or something, you've got the Republicans and the Democrats. Well, you've got the Sadducees and the Pharisees, only the Sadducees always control power. So that would be the Sanhedrin. The Pharisees come from the working class. They were the scholars of their day. They were dedicated to teaching the written and oral law. And they stressed keeping God's laws and internalizing it. And they were involved with a synagogue. So you've got the Sadducees who have the temple. You have the Pharisees who are involved with the synagogues. And there's priests among both Sadducees and Pharisees. According to Josephus, there were 6,000 Pharisees in Jesus' day. And unfortunately, they always get a bad rap in the New Testament. And I want us to change our mind about Pharisees, because it's just like anything else. When you got a few bad ones, they always are noticed. And that's exactly what happened in the New Testament. They get a lot of bad press. But for the most part, they were well-liked, certainly by the people, and they were the ones who taught them God's laws. And what were their beliefs? Well, they believed in the Torah, but they also believed in the Law and the Prophets, which is basically our Old Testament, the Tanakh. They also believed in the oral traditions. They were the ones that sought to apply the laws to their lives, to internalize it. But in order to guard against any possible breaking of God's laws, unfortunately, they went a little too far. They built fences around the law. An example is the Sabbath. God says, keep the Sabbath holy and no work on the Sabbath. So what does work mean? Well, the Pharisees says you can walk 2,000 paces, but any more is considered work. So what did that mean? It meant that a synagogue had to be within 1,000 paces of everybody's home. Why? Because you had to walk there, but you also had to get back. So that would be offense. They believed in resurrection, afterlife of the soul, and angels, and they were actively waiting for Messiah, the hope of Israel. And because they were waiting for the Messiah, they were anti-Roman. I want you to think about Judaism as we know it today. Basically, it's Pharisaic. What they were teaching is very much what the Jewish community believes today. And the rabbis of today are in the lineage of the Pharisees. So that will help us understanding. But what about the political change? Marilyn's going to now tell us about the politics of first century Roman Empire.
All right, so now we see the turmoil that was being experienced in Israel at the time of Jesus. But we need to go back just a little bit to understand what was happening and why it was happening. Well, we remember there was 400 years of silence in Israel. God did not speak to his people. But during that time, there was Greek domination. In fact, Alexander the Great took over the known world of that time in around 336 BC. Then following from Alexandra came Syrian domination of Palestine, and that was around 323 BC down to about 190. But then in 190 BC, Rome became the most powerful empire in the known world. The Roman Empire actually then included Israel, which was taken by Pompey in 63 BC. Well, what did Rome bring to Israel? Well, they brought a unified language because Greek was like English is today. It was the international language of the world. They brought the power of Rome, and along with that, they brought Pax Romana, which we know to be the peace of Rome. They brought a Roman governor into the country who would control and rule. They brought zealots and uprisings because of their oppressive rule. They also allowed a Jewish king. Well, the rise in power of groups came about because each was looking for their own self-interest. Some of these were purely political, and they were power-hungry, as you heard from Marcy's explanation of the Sadducees. But some were also religious leaders who were attempting to protect their monotheistic faith against the tide of Roman influence and polytheism. Polytheism, you know, is like a whole bunch of gods that they'll take anyone. Oh, we like that one. We'll add that one to our collection. A monotheistic religion is one where there's one God and only one. Well, the place was ripe for trouble. The country was looking for a political leader who would rid them of the Romans. The zeal of Israel wasn't dimmed by oppression, but it was fueling the fires and creating messiahs all across the country. Well, the Romans had brought roads, so they brought infrastructure. They brought waterways. They brought a central government under Caesar. They brought systematic, ruthless suppression of agitators and agitation. They also brought paganism and Hellenism, influencing the life of every conquering nation that they took over, including Israel. Well, one line of rulers who was to influence the life of Jesus from the time of his birth to the time of his death were the Herods. We start with Herod the Great, who descended from the Edomites. Under their Hasmonean dynasty, they had been forced to accept Judaism. However, they had no loyalty to the Jews and were willing to look for opportunities where they could grab power. Herod's father, Antipater, gave military aid to Julius Caesar, and he was rewarded with a title and power as the governor of Judea. Well, Rome was persuaded to give Israel particular privileges, such as being exempt from the military service, and also they allowed them to meet for their own peculiar worship. Well, there was turmoil in Rome, which ended the lives of both Antipater and Caesar in their assassinations. But the Herod that we know, Herod the Great, who was the son of Antipater, found favor in Rome, and with their help, he moved against Jerusalem, took power there in 37 BC, and became the ruler in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and Galilee as king. Now, Herod had power, but he was very insecure and fearful of any potential threat to his position, including threats from his own family. He put to death anyone he thought might oppose him, including his wife, his father-in-law, and three of his very own sons. It actually was said by Augustus Caesar that it was better to be Herod's pig than to be Herod's son. The other fact of note is that the magnificent temple that Herod built in Jerusalem, along with many other buildings, palaces, an amphitheater, and the port of Caesarea, were all done because he was a great builder. He loved architecture. The temple was begun in 19 BC and took about 10 years to complete. It went on until about 63 AD, even after Jesus had come and gone. This temple was a wonder in the ancient world. It was larger than Solomon's temple, which was decorated magnificently, and the people enjoyed it. And therefore, they put up with Herod because he had given them this beautiful temple. Herod had a Hellenistic lifestyle, and he brought in ruthless taxation and treatment of the people. But he still had admiration from those who liked the temple. Herod died in 4 BC, and his title and lands in Judea and Samaria were passed down to his son Archelaus. Lands in Galilee and Perea were passed to Antipas, and parts of the northern Transjordan and Gelatinus, which is around the Golan Heights, was passed to Philip. So now we have three sons all rushing to Rome to put their claims in, along with some Jews who didn't want any Herods to have power. However, unfortunately, Caesar Augustus recognized the three sons and gave them rule over Palestine, although he wouldn't allow them the title of king. The Herodian family continued to influence life in Palestine. Archelaus interfered in temple affairs to such an extent that in 6 AD he was removed from office by Rome and direct Roman rule was imposed on that region. Herod Antipas ruled Galilee from 4 BC to about 39 AD. He was also a builder. He built the city of Tiberias and other large projects in the region to which Jesus and his father would most likely have been employed as carpenters or stonemasons. This Herod was more in tune with Jewish sentiments, except where it interfered with his personal wishes, such as the divorce of his wife in order to marry Herodias, his brother's wife. He was strongly denounced by John the Baptist, who he then beheaded. This was after Jesus came on the scene that he was actually removed. But this was after Jesus was there. Herod Antipas was a key player in Jesus' life, as much of the ministry happened within Herod's territory in the Galilee. When Jesus went into the other regions of Jerusalem, Bethsaida, and Caesarea Philippi, he then came under the jurisdiction of the other two Herods. Well, the other major player that we find on this scene in this unfolding drama is Pontius Pilate. He is the governor of Palestine from AD 26, but he managed to infuriate the Jews from the start by ordering his military standards to be carried into the city of Jerusalem. The Jews saw this as sacrilegious because of the pagan symbols. He acted in enough anti-Jewish ways to cause complaints to Rome and to bring about local protests and violence. So, and he brought about the capital punishment, which became fairly common, that of crucifixion, a particular Roman method of suppression and horrific in its intent. We see here that the people of Israel are under the yoke of a pagan superpower. This was a rich, powerful, militarily strong, culturally influential, conquering group of people. Greco-Roman life infiltrated Judaism. Some of the families were doing very well, thank you, under Roman rule. Folk like tax collectors and high priestly families. But the poor were growing as more taxes took their toll. Taxes on goods, taxes on individuals, as well as the traditional temple tax. They affected the average person greatly, raising resentment and fear among the traditional people. The Jewish way of life was being threatened by Rome. The whole state was a simmering pot of anger and frustration, boiling over every now and then and being brutally suppressed by the Romans through massacres and crucifixions. People longed for change, and they wanted to return to their traditions, the things that marked their identity, the call to be separate, to follow the law, to worship in the temple. They wanted to go back to their religious roots. Well, at this time, we see that there are continued sacrifices going on and feasts are being celebrated. In fact, even held more dear because of the fear that Roman suppression could come at any time and remove what they already had. 3 times a year, the city of Jerusalem was filled with families from all across the country coming to the temple to obey their God and to bring sacrifices. These were also the times of greatest unrest and anxiety on the part of the Roman governors. Any turmoil was viewed with suspicion and instant repression. This will be the last piece of the puzzle for us this year, looking at the feasts of the Lord and how Jesus fulfilled these. The very fact that he does is cause for trouble in the minds and hearts of our truly devout Jews even today. Jesus did fulfill the feasts. And so here we see a picture of what is going on in Israel, and Jesus comes on the scene. This is what he comes into. So I hope that you've got a good picture to take into your mind as we begin our study on Jesus.